Welcome to Mystical Dispute, the limited Magic the Gathering debate podcast. I'm Garrett Gardner, a.k.a. G-Guards.
And I'm Carl Chase, a.k.a. 2 Duck Cubed.
Check out our monthly bonus mini-episodes on patreon.com/mysticaldispute. And thank you to our patrons. And today, we are going to debate Variance and Tilt, Part 2.
Last week, we delved into a couple of basic scenarios to introduce the concept of Variance and Tilt in Magic. But today, we are going to go quite a bit deeper, and specifically on the topic of high-level competitive play and personal competitive results in Magic the Gathering.
Carl, I am excited for you to finally contribute something useful to the podcast. I didn't ask you over a year ago to join this podcast for you complaining about removal spells or saying 1/1s are good or whatever the hell you are always complaining about here. I wanted your nerdy data skills and I finally got them.
Well, Garrett, be careful what you wish for, because one of the things that we have done for today's episode is simulate 1,000 G-Guards arena seasons to see just what your results are like over a absurdly long period of time. We have re-simulated the careers of top Pro Tour players to just understand how much variance is in a lifetime of high-level competitive play. And also, we are taking a look at what does it take to be rank number one on Arena, because 2 is not a winner, and 3 nobody remembers. What does it take to be number one? Hey, 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 hey.
And Carl, for the last part, we did a deep dive on the definition of variance. This week, I wanted to go in a little bit more detail about what it means to tilt. I think tilt has a more straightforward definition. It's just basically when you get emotional during the game and it throws you off your game. You make more mistakes, you might do worse strategies. In general, you're just playing worse because of whatever emotional state that you're in. And you can be tilted for all kinds of reasons. You can be distracted from the setting that you're in, might be loud or something like that, or you're just tired. There's plenty of ways to go on a tilt, but what we're trying to focus on here is when you tilt off about Magic games, when you are on the receiving end of bad luck, and reframing how to look at that bad luck or bad variance and see that you might not actually have as much luck involved as you might think, or there might be more than you think. But either way, if you get upset about it, you're going to play worse. So it's really good to try to fight against that.
And this can be even further amplified in high leverage or competitive situations. I won't speak for everybody, but I'll speak for myself.
Sure.
I am a very competitive person, Garrett. There is nothing that kind of gets me going more than high level competitive play. And really, anytime that I'm competing, I want to do my best. It's what drives me. It's what interests me in these games. While Magic is a very fun game to play, one of the things that I personally enjoy the most about it is trying to figure out how I can be my best at the game. And there are all sorts of different types of people and types of players with different motivations. But for me, and for plenty of us out there as well, the competitive drive is one of those motivating factors. And when you don't do your best, or when you have a result that is below what you were either hoping or expecting out of that circumstance, it can be tilting. And whether that be, you know, across a season in MTG Arena, which I'll call, you know, it's competitive, but it's relatively low stakes, to something all the way up to if you have an opportunity to play at a Pro Tour, for example, you are absolutely going to want to do your best in that circumstance. And for me, I played one. I didn't know if that would be my only one or if I'd have other opportunities as well. And in that moment, I really was putting a ton of pressure on myself to do as best as I possibly could. But when it gets down to it, 15 or 16 matches of Magic is really, really not a very big sample size.
No, and I think that is really important to highlight just how few games you can play at the top level. But not even at the top level, like including just over a month playing on Arena. It's really not that many games when there is as much variance, as much random chance as there is in the base game of Magic. And just as a reminder, we'll be arguing ourselves, right? We're going to argue our emotional amygdala versus our logical frontal cortex. So without any further ado, let's move on to
scenario one.
So I have a 62.2% lifetime win rate in Arena Best of One. That's over the last couple years. This is a real win rate. But over the entire season of Strixhaven, I had a 58.6% win rate. That might not seem like a lot, but it is. That's a huge win rate discrepancy. In addition to that, my best of three lifetime win rate is about 72%, but my Strixhaven best of three win rate was 70.4%, which is much closer to my lifetime average. And I remember this. I mean, it's been a little while, but I'm highlighting this season because throughout all of Strixhaven, I did not understand why my win rate in best of one was so much lower when my win rate in best of three was about the same. It was just infuriating to me. It was like, what am I not getting wrong about best of one in this format? Am I like completely not understanding it? Like, it threw me for a loop, honestly. You know, I prefer best of three or whatever, but like in that moment, man, did I hate best of one. I just didn't understand what I was doing wrong. And I think it highlights what we're going to talk about in
Data Crunch.
So before we get into the meat of this, we should first talk about what we mean by win rate. Simply put, win rate is how often you win games of Magic, how many wins you have over your total number of games. And in Best of One, it's even simpler because the game win rate and the match win rate is the same. Now, win rate can be really useful to see how well you're performing in a given month or a whole format or your last few drafts or whatever. And you can look up your win rate on 17 lands, including your overall lifetime win rate, a total of everything you've ever done recorded by 17 lands. Now, for this episode, we did a lot of high-level math, and to accomplish that, we used a static win rate, or just assuming that you have a baseline win rate that's always the same. Obviously, that's not ever going to reflect reality. Your true win rate is going to fluctuate, sometimes by a lot, depending on tons of different factors, like how well you're understanding or performing in the current format, your mindset, how much practice you have recently. Plus, it's probably going to increase over time. Win rate is also going to be relative to the skill level of your opponents. Obviously, you're going to have a lower win rate against more experienced players, and this applies extra to Best of One, which has ranked matchmaking. So with all those caveats in mind, for the purpose of this episode, we are trying to highlight how the inherent variance or things outside of your control or just the luck involved in Magic can affect your results. And I still think it's fair to assume that there's some static win rate for all players. After all, you could just do an overall average of all the different variables mentioned before, format knowledge, opponent skill level, your practice. You could just take all of those variables together and average them, and that resulting number would be your average win rate.
But Garrett, part of the challenge in all of this is trying to separate what has happened versus what is, I'll say, inherent to your skill level, to your capabilities, because variance plays a part in win rate, even over very large sample sizes. And what I mean by that is you've had a 62.2% win rate across 2,400 games. And you might say, hey, that's a whole heck of a lot of games. Garrett is a 62.2% win rate player. But let's conjecture a scenario where Garrett is actually really across an infinite number of lifetimes and games and sample sizes, a 63.2% win rate player. There would be a 15% chance that he would have a 62.2% win rate across 2,400 games.
So just to say that again, you're saying that there's actually a chance that even with how many games I have on 17 lands, which is in like the several thousands, there's still a sizable chance that that's not even my true win rate. And then I'm even possibly a full percentage point higher.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one in six, one in seven times across a 2,400 game sample size, his win rate is going to be a full point different. So we are going to assume that the 62.2% is a pretty good representative sample of Garrett, but we don't know for sure. We do know that there is a very, very high likelihood that he is probably naturally around, over that course of time, a 62.2% win rate player. If you go to the extremes, for example, let's say that Garrett was a 66.2% win rate player and he has gotten absurdly unlucky. There is a 1 in 40,000 chance that he has a 62.2% win rate across 2,400 games. So part of probability theory tells us that, you know, there's a range of possibilities around the average, but as you get further and further from that, and as the sample size increases, you can eliminate with all but, you know, a tiny bit of probability, the likelihood of being within a certain range. So all that said, we only have the data that we have. We only have the sample that we have. And we are going to use the win rates that we have observed lifetime for various players, ourselves, other players on 17 lands, for example, as a assumption that that is truly what we would expect out of that player over a large sample size, even though there is some variance associated with it.
So all of that to say, I think it's safe to assume that 62.2% is close enough to my lifetime win rate that we can use it.
Yeah, and as we go into some of the simulations that we're going to do today, there's actually going to be a conservative assumption in here. We're basically assuming that people's win rates aren't changing over time, which you would think would flatten the range of possible outcomes.
Right.
So as we talk about, you know, simulating 1,000 arena seasons for Garrett, for example, here, that simplifying assumption that Garrett is always 62.2% and whatever happens is just pure variance around that should really only flatten the range of possibilities. And you will see as we get into some of these numbers that there is still a wide range of possible outcomes that can occur.
So Carl, with all that housekeeping about win rates in mind, let's go back to my amygdala's problem here. I have a 62.2% win rate, and over the course of an entire format, Strixhaven, I added 58.6%. That felt terrible. And it didn't feel like I had a bad handle on the format because my best of three results were pretty good. So Carl, my frontal cortex tells me, I think I was just on the receiving end of some bad variance in best of one specifically during that time. Is my frontal cortex correct?
Here's the thing. You could have been playing at the exact same skill level and aptitude as you normally do. And purely from variance alone, there is a 1 in 5 chance that you have the win rate that you had in Strixhaven or lower of 58.6%, simply based on variance.
So Carl, you're saying like, because of the selection size of how much I played, which was like 150 or so games in Strixhaven, even if I have that 62.2% expected win rate over my lifetime, right? In 1 in 5 parallel universes, I get unlucky enough, just due to the variance inherent to Magic the Gathering, that my win rate is over 3.5% lower, which 3.5, it doesn't sound like a lot. It is a very big difference when it comes to best of one results.
Absolutely.
And it's completely outside of my control. It's just how 62.2% win rate would work over that time period. And Carl, you know, I really want to stress, like, this 3.5, nearly 4% win dip, 4% doesn't sound like a lot. It feels like a lot. It feels so much different. You are used to winning a certain amount of games, trophying a certain amount of times with a 4% dip in your entire, remember now, this is for the entirety of Strixhaven. So I had you throw together some math for this, but I trophied in this format because of that win rate a third less than I'm used to. Imagine getting 1/3 less trophies than you're used to over time. Like, it, you can feel that. That's a huge amount of trophies that you don't have on your trophy case. And honestly, I think these streaks can lead to not just like in the moment tilt, but like overarching tilt that can affect your play over time and you just remember it forever. In fact, a lot of the time I'll think back to a format I didn't perform well in and I'll be like, oh, I didn't like that format or something like that. I just have negative feelings about that moment. But you're saying 1 in 5 chance. I mean, we've had, what, probably nearly 15 formats since I started streaming. That means that in like 3 of those formats, I'm just going to perform so much worse, I'm going to feel it.
And part of the issue too is it can lead to some self-doubt. It could lead to questioning. It can lead to frustration. We talked about the fact that 1 in 5 times with the same expected win rate, this result is going to happen. But it also could be because you are missing something fundamental about the format too. Or heck, it could have been even the opposite. You could have even got the format better than others, and it just so happened that it was an extreme variance situation that happened, and you don't really know. But regardless of all of that, like you said, you will feel that.
And I did feel that. I think you bring up something really important here. How do you differentiate between getting unlucky over these streaks that are totally possible, and if you just aren't grokking something about the format, you're not understanding something about the format? And this is something that I really struggle with, because I know that this is possible, but at the same time, you don't want to ignore the data that you're performing so much worse. You feel like you're performing so much worse than normal. So my go-to is just to assume it isn't variance and try to change something about what I'm doing or my approach. But at the same time, it's not good to obsess over that when it's totally possible I'm just on the receiving end of some low end of variance. But still, it really does haunt me that I can never know for sure if that's the reason.
And just like with other highly variant scenarios, observation bias plays a huge role in how you internalize the results that you're getting. Because I think we as humans like to think about the times that we've performed our best, right?
Yeah.
Heck, think back to your childhood, right? Do you remember, you know, the time that you went 500 in your sport that you played in middle school or high school or whatever? Or do you remember the season that your team performed super well and won the championship or whatever it was, right? You're going to remember the latter. Or whatever competitive endeavor that you've partaken in your life, you tend to remember the best of times. You tend to remember the times where you've had the most success. If you internalize those times when you've had your most success, especially in something as prone to variance as magic, as what should be. This is how I should perform. This is the way that it should be all the time. And let's take Garrett for an example. We looked at 200 game blocks for Garrett as an example. And 10% of Garrett's 200 game blocks, he's going to have a 67% win rate in best of one, purely from variance. 1 in 10, 67%. That's going to come with a trophy rate that is 25% higher, for example. He's going to be up to trophying 2 out of 5 times almost at that sort of a win rate. He's going to feel that on the other end. It's going to feel great. He's going to remember that. He's going to think about that format for the rest of his life and how amazing it was. But if Garrett goes to the next format and now he's come back down to earth, back to his regular 62.2% win rate, but he says, you know what? No, I should be at 67%. That's something that I have achieved. It's a mountain that I have climbed to the summit of, and 62% feels like a failure. Well, you are setting yourself up for disappointment. You're setting yourself up for frustration. You are setting yourself up for tilt.
And I'm setting myself up for that 90% of the time. So that is absolutely going to affect how much I enjoy magic. And Carl, this isn't a theoretical. I'm talking about myself. This happens to me. This is the thing that I struggle with. And this is why I want to go over all this math and these scenarios, because it is, I think, the biggest hole that I currently have in my game.
As we talked about last week, when you're in the moment, you might not internalize good luck as some anomaly, whereas you will definitely internalize bad luck as an anomaly. But if, again, like you think about the way your games have gone, when you're running at that 67%, Garrett, you might say, this is the way that magic should go. And now your games all feel like you're getting unlucky. And you say, you know what? I get unlucky in all of my games because look at this 62% win rate. I should be at 67. And look at these things happening in my games. I'm drawing all mountains and blue cards and blah, blah, blah. And I'm flooding out, or I'm getting mana screwed way more often than I was last season when I had my 67% win rate. Now all of a sudden you are maybe internalizing game variance in the wrong way. And so each of these games feel like they're going poorly. And it can spiral, and you can turn yourself into a dark spot in the way that you feel about magic very quickly. And again, Garrett says he's speaking from his experience, and really, this is basically what I do every day of my life playing magic all the time, is this sort of stuff in my head, and I need my frontal cortex to come back and be like, Carl, variance, dude, there's variance, man. You know how you need to process this, but you're not doing it, amygdala.
So, Carl, the truth about these episodes come out.
They do.
This is an intervention for each other.
Absolutely.
I hope it's going well. All right, Carl, let's move on to
scenario 2.
Garrett, as I mentioned, I am a very competitive person, and one of the reasons I play godforsaken best of one instead of best of three, as Richard Garfield intended, is that best of one premier draft is ranked on MTG Arena. And I love the allure of competing against the best on Arena in pursuit of the number one ranking. Unfortunately, on the flip side, I get very cranky very often when I'm close and just don't quite get there. And it really turns my amygdala up to full speed, as you know very well from the rants that I unfortunately often leave in your DMs.
I'm well aware, Carl, but I'm also well aware of your sick nerd data skills. So let's hear about those a little bit more in
Data Crunch.
We are not going to let the amygdala do the talking today. This is going to be pure frontal cortex nerding out.
All right, good. And we have Carl's frontal cortex to thank here for this next spot. So Carl created a model to simulate seasons of Best of One Ranked. Essentially, he took the most prolific Magic Arena players on 17 lands and pit them against each other 1,000 times and recorded the results. So it's kind of like Carl the Data Magician created 1,000 identical parallel universes and had a bunch of grinders play a season's worth of arena games in each of them. In each universe, everything is completely identical except that all the decks were shuffled differently.
Yes, we are letting the win rates that everybody has be our guide and let variance change the world. So the slightly nerdier version of this is I took the 500 players with the most wins all time in Premier Draft from 17 lands, looked at their lifetime win rates, and used those to simulate a 200 game season 1,000 times for every single one of those players. This is not a perfect simulation of an actual ranked arena season because, first of all, we're assuming these are the only 500 players that are competing. Number two, we are assuming that everybody plays the exact same number of games, which is not even remotely close to a reasonable assumption since some players are playing 1,000 games in a season or something crazy and some play much. Some don't play many at all. But again, we're trying to just restrict the bounds to just show what variance is doing and eliminate some of the other variables in this. So again, we're assuming all 500 of these players play exactly 200 games. And across those 200 games, whoever has the most wins or the highest win rate is going to win the season. Again, it's not exact mimic of actual arena, but it'll give us some insight into what the variance is doing. So I happen to be in this set of 500 players at a 63.2% win rate. Across these 1,000 parallel universes of 200 game seasons, I have a 63.2% win rate simulated.
So your real win rate and the average of all the simulated win rates ended up being exactly the same.
Yes, the power of large numbers. However, in one of these seasons, I had a 75% win rate, one of these parallel universes, and in another one, I had a 52% win rate. So again, once you get to the extremes, the outskirts of the distribution, there can be pretty wild outcomes that occur.
Yeah.
But what happens when you put me and really anybody in the mix of all 500 players? And what we're going to examine is what does it take to be number one? Because two is not a winner and three no. Nobody remembers. What does it take to be number one? Hey.
Didn't you already do that joke?
You're getting in the way of the math. So in any given season, Garrett, what do you think the win rate that it would require to come out on top of all 500 of these highly prolific 17 lands players and win the season?
Given that I know from 17 lands, the top performing players over all the seasons, it's about like 65.5% is probably what I would expect.
Wrong. In any given one of these parallel universes, the average win rate of the top player is about 73%. So to win a season, on average, you need to be a 73% win rate across 200 games. And keep in mind, that is with the actual top win rate out of all these players being 68.5%. If you go down to the 20th best win rate across all 500 of these players, it's like 65.1%. So you've got 480 players that are below 65%, and yet you need to score a 73% win rate to win the season, which is higher than literally every single player.
So, Carl, all these numbers you're throwing around, all this nerd talk, what you're essentially saying is that in order to get number one among all these other players in a given season, you have to perform like way better than your average. Even if your average is the best among everyone else.
Yeah, and you can illustrate this by taking one of the top players and seeing how often in these universes we've constructed that they are going to win the season. Let's take Kyle Rose, who has a lifetime win rate of 67.8% in Premier Draft, second best on 17 lands.
It's really high.
Yeah. And out of the 1,000 parallel universes, Kyle wins 63 of these times. So about 6.3% of the time, or if you look at that, once every 14 months or so, Kyle's going to take home the number one crown. Now, we got to heavily caveat this again, because everybody doesn't play the same number of games, and volume definitely matters when it comes to ranked performance in MTG Arena. So again, not perfectly simulating what the actual ranked experience is, but again, gives you the idea of the kind of results that you're going to need to have to start to climb higher and higher compared to others.
I mean, what your model is really illustrating here is that you can be second best. I mean, Kyle Rose is, you know, he's an excellent, excellent limited player. And you're saying that, you know, with your model, caveat or not, he's still not going to be number one with any modicum of regularity, certainly not a majority of the time, despite constantly being among the best players throughout the entire season.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a pretty big difference between achieving something like number one and achieving, say, a top 10 rating. The average 10th placed finisher across all of these 1,000 parallel universes was about 68.5%. And so now you look at someone like Kyle, who's got a 67.8% win rate, and that's pretty well within his pretty normal range. And so for someone with that high of a win rate, they can pretty consistently expect to be near the top 10. But again, when you're competing against a very high volume of people, the chance that there is an outlier or even just an amazing performance is pretty high. And there are some seasons too, like that was just the average win rate that is needed to win a season. But there's one of these seasons where somebody achieved a 79.5% win rate across those 200 games. And that is a humongous outlier across a sample size of 200. So you could have your outlier season. You have your best season that you've ever had. Remember that I said my best was a 75% across these thousand, my fake best. Fake Carl's best season across 1,000 parallel universes was a 75% win rate. Well, if that 75% came in that season where somebody else had a 79.5, I ain't winning. And so timing matters there a lot too.
And Carl, we're talking about a lot here about number one, and I know you made number one twice, and congratulations, that's a really awesome thing for you to achieve, but I don't think I'm ever going to make number one, and many people are not going to make number one. But I think that a lot of this can apply no matter where you are in the ladder, to illustrate that even the top players only have a small chance of actually making number one. And I imagine that works among all the other ranks. Like, some people may not actually make it to Mythic some amount of the time, even though they're very favored to do so, right?
And yeah, just like we talked about in the personal results sections, sometimes you're just going to perform significantly worse than your average, and you're not going to achieve, you know, the result that you're hoping for. And Garrett, what especially rang true for me is that when you said, I may never achieve number one, because fake Garrett in the simulation did not win any of the seasons.
Over 1,000 parallel universes. You're telling me your simulation had me winning zero?
Yeah, and there was quite a few people with worse win rates than you in the simulation that won like four seasons, but this particular fake Garrett did not win any. I won five, by the way, so one in 200. So my result of doing it twice is clearly a major positive outlier on my end. And, you know, volume might have something to do with that as well.
Carl, I think you rigged it against me.
I absolutely did not, but it's funny nonetheless. And here's the salient point in all of this, and this is very much Carl's frontal cortex talking to Carl's amygdala, like literally happens in my brain. I cannot internalize the results that I've had in my two number one seasons as normal. In particular, in the most recent season I was number one, I had a 75% win rate over about 125 games. I can't internalize those results as normal for me, because if I do, I will just be miserable. There's no way that I can continue to trophy 10 out of 13 drafts where I had a run like that or somewhere in that season. It's just not going to happen.
I mean, you said it yourself, right, Carl? That season you had a 75% win rate. Your average overall is 63.2%. That's 12% higher. In the last section, we were talking about how 3% feels bad. 12% must have made you feel great. I mean, it's a huge, huge jump up. Although, Carl, you still deserve props for that season. I mean, you performing that much higher probably means you had a really good grasp on the format. But when we're talking about 12%, that's not just skill. That's not just aptitude. It's also luck. It's also variance on your side that helped you out in that moment.
Definitely.
So again, all this to say, win rate is a good litmus test and how well you're performing, but there is a lot of variance that can go into it over a season. And I need to drill into myself that I am not my win rate, and I can either be, as we said, on the bad side, like I was with Strixhaven, or you can be on the good side and you can end up being number one rated mythic at a much higher win rate than your average. Either way though, variance is coming into play to some degree every time you play this game.
So this is talking about MTG Arena, competitive ranked, but let's talk about the highest level of competitive Magic the Gathering in
bonus round.
So Garrett, I'm coming up on almost 10,000 games played on MTG Arena.
Wow.
And that might seem like a lot, and it is. But I wanted to compare that to the number of opportunities that even the most prolific pros have to play on the Pro Tour. Take Raphael Levy, who has over 1,400 games played in the Pro Tour. He is the number one most prolific pro in terms of the number of games played. Even if you adjust for best of one versus best of three, that's still like a third the number of games as I've played on MTG Arena. And that is the most prolific pro of all time. Even as you go down the list, the 150th most prolific pro has about 320 games played at the Pro Tour. That's like almost one of the MTG Arena seasons that we were talking about in the last example. And so the point here is that at the highest levels of competitive Magic, there are only a few opportunities for you to compete. And there is going to be a ton of variance associated with these small sample sizes.
And so, Carl, with so few opportunities to perform at that level, I imagine these amygdalas are going wild.
Absolutely. You're playing matches that are worth thousands of dollars. You're playing, you know, matches to try to have the opportunity to play more Pro Tours. They are higher stakes than almost any other opportunity you have to play. And yet the same rules are going to apply. Sometimes you're not going to draw lands. Sometimes your opponents are going to have nut draws. All the same variance that comes along with Magic applies. Take somebody like Paulo Vitor Dama de Rosa, who is not only one of the most prolific pros of all time, but one of the most successful. Paulo has a 61.5% match win rate at the Pro Tour. So that's one of the best players ever.
And definitely worth pointing out, 61% in the context of the Pro Tour. Like at a Pro Tour, you're competing against the best of the best, and a 61% is extremely impressive.
And so with that, what I wanted to do was understand just how much variance there is in the lifetime of a highly prolific Magic the Gathering pro. And literally, we're talking a lifetime of Pro Tours.
Well, Carl, why don't you break down what you did in
Data Crunch.
So Garrett, you only live once. And like we said, even the most prolific pro has only had the opportunity to play 1,400 games at the Pro Tour level. But what if we looked at 100 parallel universes based on the statistics of well-known pros? What is the range of possible outcomes with the exact same win rate and essentially number of events played? How often might you make the Pro Tour in lifetime 1 versus lifetime 12 versus lifetime 37 that we've simulated here? And so what I did was I pulled the top 150 most prolific Magic the Gathering pros and their data from the MTG Elo project, which is a fantastic website, by the way. And I took their Pro Tour lifetime win rate and approximate number of events played based on their total games and basically resimulated their career and did so 100 times.
So you took the 150 Magic pros with the most Pro Tour games played and using their lifetime win rates made them play a number of simulated Pro Tour events approximately based on how many games they played in real life. Got it.
Now, again, just like with the last example, we made similar simplifying assumptions. We've assumed that the lifetime win rate is static, which we know is not really true, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Especially for some of the folks that have more longevity, there's likely times in their careers where they were highly engaged and highly focused on Magic, and other times where, especially for the Hall of Famers, maybe were even just playing without much focus at all, potentially dropping their win rate below their kind of true inherent potential. So again, this is not going to be a perfect simulation, but again, it'll give you some really interesting ideas of just how much variance comes along with the pro lifetime. I've also made a simplifying assumption here that all of the events that were played are similar to kind of the old school pro tours. I've assumed 450 player pro tours roughly, and that these players will have that same lifetime win rate in that 450 player tournament. More or less across the first 15 rounds of a 16-player tournament, you're going to need to get to a 12-3 win rate or better to make top 8. And so those are the simplifying assumptions that I've used. Not perfect, but you will see that it comes out with pretty reasonable assumptions when all is said and done. Anyway, let's get into some of the interesting facts. I'm going to go back to PV, Paul Vitor Dama de Rosa. Again, one of the most successful players of all time.
Sure.
So in real life, if you exclude the world's top eights, since a lot of times those were smaller events and doesn't really work in our simulation, Paulo's got 11 top eights across non-world pro tour events. Across the 100 lifetimes that I've simulated here for PV, he's got 9 top eights. So pretty well within a range of what actually happened there. But if you look at the extremes, there is one fake lifetime for Paulo where he had 16 top eights, and one fake lifetime where he had only three top eights. If you take that even further to pro tour wins, 36% of the time, or 36% of these fake lifetimes, Paulo did not win a pro tour. But one of them, he won 6 of them. And again, we're simulating whole lifetimes of the most prolific pros ever. And sometimes he's got 16 top eights and sometimes he's got 3. And if you look at his actual accomplishments, he's got 2 wins in larger events and 1 win in a smaller field event. So kind of in the midpoint of the possible outcomes.
And Paulo is undoubtedly one of the best, if not the best, Magic player of all time. I think a lot of people would agree with that. And you're saying that in a third of these alternate universes, he's actually never won a pro tour at all.
Exactly. We've got it, again, for the top 150 pros. So take someone like Luis Scott Vargas, who doesn't have quite as many events as Paulo has played, but a similar win rate. And across a similar, you know, again, we're assuming a similar number of events in each of these lifetimes. There is one fake lifetime where LSV had 18 top eights and one fake lifetime where he had 1 top 8 with an average of 8.
Which matches real life, where he had 8.
So again, if you are trying to not only compete at the highest level, but you are measuring the success of a career in things like top 8s and things like wins, there could be players out there that we don't really know their names because they had the same aptitude and ability as someone like a LSV or Apollo or pick any other of the top pros' names on the list, and they ran bad at pro tours. Just plain and simple. It is a distinct possibility. These sample sizes are not large, so it is possible that one of the MTG goats is out there hiding in plain sight, just has had bad variance in pro tours. And again, this all assumes that the win rate that each of these players have had is their true inherent win rate. Who's to say that some of the folks at the top of this list aren't actually even better than what their stats show, right? We don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Paul is actually better than 61.5. Maybe John Finkel, who's got a 62.7, maybe he's even better. Who knows? None of these things are really knowable because, again, a whole lifetime of pro events is, in fact, a small sample size when it comes to statistics.
Now, Carl, I have a little bit of a counterpoint to your model here based on this whole concept of win rates, right? I mean, I think more than any other game type or tournament type, like a pro tour is going to see the biggest variance in the base win rate of a player going into it, right? Like someone is going to either spend 40 hours a day training for a pro tour, or maybe they just showed up because they happened to be in town or whatever. And I would hazard to guess a lot of these top performing pros, they had a significantly higher win rate going into the ones that they may have won than they did overall over their whole career. So can you imagine a very variant pro who might go into one of these events with an 80% win rate, which I think is probably pretty far and away from reality? Like if anybody has an 80% win rate in this game, maybe they have the best meta deck and they have the best knowledge, the best understanding of whatever format it is. But 80% is like well beyond what I think many people can expect. But let's just assume that even with that pro, how often are they going to top eight, and how often are they going to win?
So this thing that you're describing, Garrett, might even be a once-in-a-lifetime type of thing for even some of the more prolific pros, right? You have broken the format. You've come to the Pro Tour with by far the best deck in the room, and there is extra pressure because you know you have the best deck. You know that this is your opportunity to make top eight and win the event.
Right.
Even with an 80% win rate, you're only 65% to top eight that event.
So, Carl, what about winning the whole thing, though?
But let's say instead of 12.5%, which is 1 in 8, once you get to the top eight, let's say you're even a third to win that top eight. You know, you're still only going to be about 1 in 5 or so to win that Pro Tour in this once-in-a-lifetime scenario.
So despite going into this event with a ludicrously high win rate, you're saying your chances of taking the whole thing down are still really low.
And so while, yes, across this model that I've built, it doesn't take into account a non-static win rate, a changing win rate depending on time and event and all that, there's still going to be significant inherent variance in the real world at the highest levels.
Yeah, Carl, I really like how you broke this down. And I think this can be extrapolated past the pros, right? Again, I'm probably never going to be a pro. But where I can extrapolate this is like an Arena Open or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Some big level event that I only have a couple chances to actually cash in. And the truth of the matter is there's just too few games for it to be like guaranteed. Even if I go in with this, you know, magical 85% win rate on some limited format that I am just absolutely crushing. And I actually did the math here. Let's just assume that I qualify for day two of an Arena Open. That just happens. Even with that absurd 80% win rate, I would only have a 66% chance of cashing day two. That's 1 in 3 times I'm not going to cash with an absurd win rate. Even if you take that win rate down to a more reasonable 70%, my chance to cash is 41%. So I'm actually not favored to even cash. So I just need to tell myself like not to expect that type of result in a given tournament or even in a couple years worth of Arena Opens.
And, you know, it applies for qualifying for the Pro Tour, which because of the demand.
Yeah.
To play at the highest levels is exceedingly hard these days, right? And it's ever changing, and there's new ways to do that, you know, now versus a year ago. But even so, take the current structure, like the current tabletop structure, where you've got RCQs and then regional championships. First of all, you're going to have to find the time to go to your regional championship qualifier. And even if you're able to play 2 or 3 times, you still have to get one of those 1 or 2 slots to qualify for the regional championship. And there's a finite number of those opportunities. And all it can really take is one match where you don't draw lands and spells and you're done, even if you're playing great. And then you've got to be one of the top performers at the regional championship to qualify for the Pro Tour. And there's quite literally only, I believe, 4 of those per year. And so again, very finite opportunities. And sometimes even the best players are just not going to qualify in those moments. Even if they're potentially one of the best in the room, they still might not qualify. That's just going to be the way that it plays out.
And extrapolate this to any tournament. You know, I mean, you bought tickets to fly out to a Magic Fest or something like that, and you really want to spike in day two. But there's just so often you're not going to do that, just not based on your skill, but based on variance. I mean, you can even say that about FNM. Like, maybe you actually hit up every single FNM for a whole year, but that's 52. That's only, what, like 150 games overall? It is pretty likely that you're going to perform, I don't know, 10% worse than your whatever that secret magic average win rate that you should have is. And I think it's really important to not beat yourself up over that sort of thing, because that's what I do. That's what I'm trying to make as my big point to myself. Don't get upset at these tournament results, because it's just such a small sample size for such a high variance game.
I want to finish this off with a positive spin on this in
closing arguments.
So we've been talking a lot about negative variance and tilt, and how even performing at your best or the highest levels, sometimes the outcome that you want just isn't going to occur. But I almost want to flip this the other direction too. Part of what makes this game great is that anybody that sits down across the table from anybody else can win a game of Magic.
Yeah.
And part of what a variant game does is it creates that situation over a very large sample size. Those that are the best of the game are going to have the best results.
Yeah.
But I've been playing Magic really, again, seriously for probably 16 years now. And I think I have slowly, continuously improved over that period of time. But part of, for me, what kept me going was knowing that I had the opportunity to play at the highest levels of the game. And going into that PTQ back in the day, or playing the Magic Online qualifier, or whatever it may be, there was always that possibility that you went X and one or whatever and made the top eight. And then all you had to do was win three matches from that point forward. And while difficult, it's always a possibility. I think there is something beautiful about that opportunity. And for me, one of the things that really keeps me invested in Magic is knowing there is a pathway to play Magic at the highest level.
Very well said, Carl. And I'd like to thank you for the very awesome models that you put together. I've been thinking about these episodes for a long time, and I'm being selfish here. This is for me, right? I feel tilt in games when I draw my fifth land in a row or I get really unlucky. But I think what really gets me is these longer streaks over a long period of time where I feel like, oh man, did I lose my edge? Do I really not understand this format? And it's nice to know that while I still should take that as a data point and I should never stop improving, it's always a possibility that no, I'm just getting unlucky for an extended period of time. Variance does not just appear in this game with your draws in a specific game. It can rear its head over a long period of time, and it's good to remember that, because at least for me, I can be really hard on myself. And I love this game. I don't want to walk away from it. So just having this in the back of my head really does help me realize, like, oh, well, maybe it'll turn around, or maybe it's outside of my control and I should just keep trying, push forward, and keep improving.
And hopefully what both my amygdala, as well as, you know, I hope, you know, some of you are able to take away from this, is trying to take yourself away from results-based thinking when possible.
Yeah.
I won that game, therefore I did everything right. I lost that game, therefore I did everything poorly, is just not how it's going to go. But trying to focus on every play of every turn and thinking through, you know, what is it that I can do to play this turn as best as I possibly can is just going to be the best way to get the best results over time. And trying to not internalize both your best win streaks as well as your worst losing streaks.
Well, Carl, I'm going to call this episode in favor of our frontal cortexes. Take that, amygdalas. I think we've defeated you this week.
And Garrett, you are especially going to need your frontal cortex to edit what I believe will be the longest episode of Mystical Dispute of all time. You're welcome.
You're not wrong. Well, that about wraps it up. Finally, so thanks for listening to Mystical Dispute. You can support the show at Patreon. I'm Garrett Gardner. You can find me at twitch.tv/gguards.
And I'm Carl Chase. You can find me at twitch.tv/2duckcubed.
Huge shout out to 17 Lands for the data. You can support them on Patreon as well. And a special shout out to MTG ELO Project, who made this episode possible. You can check that out at mtgeloproject.net. Until next time, and I mean this more than ever, stay chill.
Adios.
And today, we are going to debate Variance and Tilt, Part 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm sorry.
I mean, it's a...
I couldn't help it.
It's a solid, mediocre joke.